My name is Dick Anderson. I am alcoholic. And I'm very, very grateful to be here, and I'm especially grateful to be here. I got hooked on these kind of events when I was probably 3 weeks sober and just out of my little slippers and my robe where I was drying out and had 4 days of DTs. They put me on a van, and we went to what was supposed to be an annual dinner there in Atlanta, and there were probably 600 people, and the speaker was a gentleman named Chuck Chamberlain. And that was my introduction to speaker meetings. And I have been hooked ever since. And what I've been hooked on more than anything else was the enthusiasm, the laughter, and the love that just I felt every time I would walk into a room full of AAs. It never fails. And that enthusiasm is here. Enthusiasm comes from the Greek word en theos, which means God in us. And so tonight I'm going to ask some do something I've never done before, but I'm going to ask, or I've done it once before. And since there's so much God in this room, we got Barbara and I got notified yesterday that one of our best friends, a woman who was there in that place where I dried out and helped me, she had a year and a half more than me. And recently when Barbara was laid off, helped Barbara get a job, and one of our best friends was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And we just found out about that yesterday. So I'm going to ask for a moment of silence. And if you will, pray for my friend Toni Curry. She lives in Atlanta, and she's got 34 years. She's a beautiful woman. And I know that prayer works because 4 years ago tonight, I was in a hospital, and I had less than 1% chance to live because I had esophageal cancer, and they were getting ready to do an operation on me the next day. And chances were I wasn't going to make it. And I can pretty well tell you that I have made it. So so if you will, just join me for... There is great power in this program. And we're just not the ones who have it. But if you would, join me for just a moment and think of my friend Toni. Thank you, God. Thank you very much, and I want to thank Donald and Emmy and the entire committee. We've been absolutely, the hospitality here is every bit as warm as it is down south, and they've taken care of us from one end to the other. We have a beautiful room. Anything, we have not lacked for anything, so we will come back anytime you want us to, and we appreciate that. So, and I also want to thank Wayne. Wayne was our, you've got a lot of committee people. Wayne was the, stayed in touch with me and all the way through. And Carl came out to pick us up yesterday and did all of the things that are important to do before an AA event. We were, well, before we ever got to the hotel, we went to Walmart and to the diner. So, you know all the things we do. And so, and I also want to, the speakers this weekend have been wonderful. I haven't been able to make it to everything. I don't think you can make it to everything. You've got so much stuff going on. But Tommy last night, I had met Tommy. I've seen Tommy and never heard her story before. And if you missed her, you need to get the tape because it was absolutely wonderful. And I was just very, very moved by her talk. And she's just a beautiful, beautiful spirit. Tomorrow morning is my sponsor, the man that I follow, that I want to be like, and he has 50 years of sobriety. If you didn't see him last night, he was the one that was the last one standing at the countdown, and he got sober for the people that are young out there. He got sober when he was 24 years old, and so, yeah. And Ed and Ann, I wasn't able to see all the local speakers, but Ed and Ann this afternoon and the early timers were just magnificent. But I must say that the best speaker of the weekend was the Al-Anon speaker this afternoon. No, I must say that. So... acceptance is the key is our theme, and I think that what's really interesting about that is I was a delegate about the time that we were printing the fourth edition of the Big Book, and if you see the two pages up here, it used to be on page 449 in the third edition, and then they changed it to 417. I got and know of more complaints about the fact that they changed from 449 to 417. Apparently, people didn't want to accept that change. We are an interesting group of people. I had no idea what to accept or what not to accept before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know what was real and wasn't real. I was separated from God. I had no connection with God. I thought there was a God. I thought God had a lot of power, but I didn't think God was going to do anything for me. I thought God had turned his back on me. I didn't feel like I fit into my family, and from the very beginning, I didn't feel like I fit into my family. I didn't accept who I was or the family that I was from. I remember going to a junior high school where a lot of the kids had money, and I felt like my family really didn't stand up to their family, and didn't really get to know or appreciate my family until later. But I came from a family of honor, not a family of wealth, but a family of honor, and an all-military family. My dad was one of the most decorated World War II pilots. He was a P-51 pilot and won the Army Cross, which is like next to the Medal of Honor, Silver Star, quite a few other ribbons. My little sister is a retired bird colonel. Her husband's a retired bird colonel. Their son graduated from West Point. And this thing really gets worse. I am named for my great-grandfather, who was General Richard. I'm Richard Jefferson Anderson. He was Richard Heron Anderson, who was a three-star general under Robert E. Lee. And his grandfather was Richard Clow Anderson, who was a general under George Washington. And so, and I can even Google, I know how to Google Yahoo and Bing now. And this is a picture who actually looks like our family, and you can Google my family. And this is what it says about the man I was named for. Richard Heron Anderson was a career U.S. Army officer fighting with distinction in the Mexican-American War. He also served as a Confederate general during the American Civil War. Now, this is why I didn't fit in to the family. Anderson was also noted for his humility. So, I look like the rest of the family, but there's something, I can't tell you what happened, but I am just the one who didn't fit in. I was stealing a nickel off my mom's dresser to go get a candy bar when all the rest of them were serving, and they this was not a family that drank. They didn't go to the VFW and brag about things. These were very honorable people who just served their country. And so from the very beginning, I knew I didn't fit in. And, you know, it's interesting, we get to this program, we find out about these spiritual principles, but the world has had these spiritual principles for a long time, and they're found in many places. And they were given to me when I was a kid, the organizations I belonged to, Little League, YMCA, 4-H, Church, Boy Scouts. You know, Boy Scouts, our handbook said that the way we please God best is to do something to help someone else each day anonymously. That's exactly what we do here. But until I got to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't see it, I couldn't read it. I think for people like me, that is the decoder, that is the thing that translates the principles of life to me. And I couldn't get it any other way, and I had to get here to find it. Now, growing up as I did, and feeling like I didn't fit in, and I felt that way from the very beginning, I went through the motions, I did what I was supposed to do, but I felt very, very apart, I felt very alone, and there was only one place that I felt like I connected. I grew up in the 50s, and there was a small invention. It was a little black and white tube in a box called a television, and I, for some reason, could connect to television as though it were real. But I just felt totally disconnected from real life. And the shows that were on at that time were great moral teachers. Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, The Andy Griffith Show. And this became my moral compass. Somebody said, I think it was Ann today was talking about staying up for the Johnny Carson show. I used to stay up for the Jack Parr show. And before Johnny Carson. But I would watch these shows, and they became my moral compass. If Opie or Wally got off the beam somewhere, by the end of the show, Dad had taken his pipe and just turned it one way, and without judgment, I grew up in a Baptist church, so I was really not looking for judgment, and would just take his pipe and say something wise, and by the end of the show, Opie or Wally got the message and got back on the beam. And this became, I really felt more alive in those television programs. I can't tell you, and it's still that way today. And I had my first spiritual experience, went to the drive-in, I think it was in 56, 57, and I had never seen anything in color, and this was a movie that was not only in color, it was in Technicolor. And it was 120 feet wide up there on the screen. The big book says, lack of power is our dilemma. And that's exactly, I couldn't enunciate that, but that's exactly how I felt. You know, my dad's in his flight suit going off someplace, and my uncles, I mean, they're all officers, and they're all doing all this stuff, and I didn't fit in, and I thought, they had something I didn't have. They were born with something I didn't have. That's the way I felt. So lack of power was my dilemma. And up on the screen that night at the drive-in, 120 feet wide, was the kind of power I had been looking for. The movie was called The Ten Commandments, and there was this guy named Moses. And Moses had his big staff, and he would just turn it like this way, and the wind would blow in his hair, and suddenly the Red Sea would part. And I said, man, that is the kind of power that I would like to have. And I made two decisions that night. One, that whatever that was up there, I wanted to be around that thing up there on the screen. And what I found as far as a part of my spiritual awakening is that God didn't just start hearing me when I got to AA. God was listening to me all along. And basically, that's what I've done. I'm a writer, I'm a producer, and that's what I've been doing for the last 35 years. So God heard me and was preparing me for that even at that point, because that's where the place that I left. The second decision I made, though, was that I wanted to be on God's side, because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so the next day, I went down the aisle, much to the surprise of my parents, who didn't know that I was having any kind of spiritual awakening. And I got dipped and dunked at Linden Baptist Church, and I think the song was We Surrender All, and I surrendered all I had. I was about 4 feet tall, and I just surrendered everything I had. But I was like the newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and comes to meetings, but I didn't do anything to change. And you know what I didn't have back then, which is a marvel, if you're new, let me tell you, there's a marvelous thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's someone called a sponsor. And that sponsor is somebody you can go to and say, I don't know what I'm doing. And they don't laugh at you most of the time. And, you know, it's how you do it. And I didn't have a sponsor, so I didn't have anybody to tell me what was going on. And I didn't have anybody to tell me that my dad, later on I found my dad was scared when he was shot down. But I didn't know that. I didn't have anybody to talk to. I didn't have a sponsor. So I was like that guy who doesn't have a sponsor, and I didn't do anything to change. And I was just going to the meetings. I was going to church, but I didn't take any of the steps to change. And if you don't change, it doesn't get any better. And because I didn't change, I thought that God didn't care for me. He wanted these other people, and they were smiling. And so now I already felt like I didn't fit in with people. Now I feel like I didn't fit in with God. And the only thing I could do from there was even isolate more and spend more time in my fantasy world. Because in my fantasy world, I was doing fine. And so that's the way I continued. I had my next spiritual experience when I was 14 years old. Now, on the outside, I'm doing all the right things. I was making good grades. I was in the advanced class. I was playing baseball, football, a lot of sports. And that my buddy and I were playing Babe Ruth League baseball, and we were camping out, and his older brother got us a six-pack of beer and a half pint of gin. And my family didn't have any drinking. Our family reunions, we had iced tea and lemonade and so forth, and didn't really see alcohol, so I didn't know anything about it, nor did I have any desire to try it. But my buddy said that it would be a good thing for us to do, so I drank the beer, he drank the gin. And it's called distilled spirits, I think for a good reason. I felt like I had the same experience that Moses must have felt when he was on that rock over the Red Sea, and and the wind was blowing through his hair, and all that power was there. Any fear that I had was taken from my body. I was totally drained. I felt tall. I felt capable. I felt confident. From the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk, and going to town when you're 14 meant hitchhiking. And at midnight, the only place to hitchhike was to a place called the White Castle. And I don't know if they have any up here, but White Castle is that place that you go, they make these little square hamburgers with about 800 onions on them, and it seems like a good idea to have 12 of them at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're drunk. So my buddy Dave and I hitchhike up to the White Castle, and Dave's not having the same spiritual experience I am, and Dave was starting to get a little woozy, and so I had never had a cup of coffee either. But I have seen in Perry Mason where if you have too much to drink, you have some coffee and it'll sober you up so you can talk to the police. Wait, it's going to come in handy. So I order a cup of coffee for my buddy Dave, and Dave's drinking the coffee, and I've found a whole new set of friends. I've been to this White Castle before, but these people weren't there. And I'm table hopping and talking to all the people, and flirting a little bit with a red-headed waitress that was there. I'm 14, and about this time, Dave didn't have the desired effect, and Dave threw up down the stainless steel counter. Well, as it turns out, if you're looking for a Louisville City policeman at midnight, the best place to find them is at the White Castle. So two of them came down. Now, I would have been scared to death to talk to a policeman before. I would have been scared my dad would find out. And this guy came down and said, "What's the matter with your friend?" I said, "He's just had a little bit too much to drink." "Really? How old's he?" "14. How old are you?" "14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been locked up 22 times. Only one DUI, and none of them for crimes of commerce. I didn't make any money off anything. I didn't steal anything I could sell. There were 21 times for defiance. I was the guy, if my buddy was stopped along the side of the road and a trooper had him pulled over, I would stop to kind of straighten things out. My buddies loved to see me coming because they got to go home and I was the one in the handcuffs that they took in. I got locked up 6 times my senior year in high school. Now, here's a kid who made 1480 on his SATs out of 1600 back then. Could have gotten into Brown, Harvard, Yale, any place I wanted to go. Was in the advanced class and everything else. And I barely made it out of high school because of my behavior. My senior year, I got locked up 6 times. Now, I'd been thrown in the juvie tank I don't know how many times. And this time, I get locked up at my senior prom. Now, I went to a high school. This was before busing. I went to a high school, and I thought I knew all about race relations because there were two black kids that went to our school, and I knew both of them, and I got along with them, played football with one of them. And so I thought I knew all about that. I get locked up. I'm over 18. This is in Louisville, Kentucky. The same time we have the prom, we have something else called the Kentucky Derby, which attracts quite an audience. So I got locked up in the felony tank. They put me in with 7 other felons because the bay was 8 bunks, and they're in there. Now, because of the way I drank Country Club malt liquor before I went to homeroom when I was in high school, and because of the way I drank, the colonel didn't, you know, I got the talk, if you can't behave, you can't stay here. So I got an apartment, shared an apartment with some older kids, even when I was in high school, and then would use blackmail to get my mom to let me back in the house. And that's the way I was. And here's the deal. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you that my drinking problem really started my last 2 years. My last 2 years, I lived in a basement apartment. I hadn't been paying the rent. I didn't have any furniture. I had a little TV. I slept on the bathroom floor. Because I hadn't been paying the rent, I couldn't tell them that it was flooded through the retaining wall. And I slept on the bathroom floor. I would pass out, come to, get a little bit down, dry heave. I was hallucinating. I was hearing things come out of the heating duct. I'd lost control of my kidneys and my bowels. I was estranged from everybody. I didn't talk to anybody, and that's the way I lived. And the only thing I did was get out of there occasionally to walk up to the liquor store. But here's what happened the first 3 times I take a drink. The first time I take a drink, I get locked up. And in my family, that wasn't a good thing. Nobody in my family had ever been locked up. And the only thing I can think of is the next time I'm going to take a drink. The second time, I was playing JV football on a team that we transferred to another school, and one of the older kids got something. I asked him to get me something that a girl would like. I had a date, and he got cherry vodka, and which I highly recommend for those of you who are going out to have a slip. And the third time I took a drink, I drank Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, which is what I drank until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't enjoy the taste of any of those the first time. But each one got me there quicker. The only thing I was concerned about was the feeling. The second thing that happened during that few weeks when I took my first 3 drinks, I was the quarterback on the JV football team, and I was absolutely, disconnected from people, disconnected from God, but I was absolutely infatuated with the girl who was the captain of the JV cheerleaders. We talked every night for 2 or 3 hours. We went on hay rides. We went to movies. We did all this together. She was the center of my universe. She was the most important person ever in my life. I was absolutely infatuated in love with her. If you had tried to come between me and her, I would have fought you to the death. She called me after I got in trouble over drinking and said, I haven't told you this before because I didn't really want to tell you, but my dad drinks. He has a problem with it. When he drinks, he gets mean and it's not pretty, and I would like for you not to drink while we're dating. And it didn't take me that long to break up with her. She was the most important person in my world, and I broke up with her just like that, and I'd only had a drink 2 or 3 times. That's how much control alcohol had on me from the very beginning. So by the time I was a senior and I get locked up at that point, and I'm sharing an apartment with other kids that drank like I did, and I was getting in and out of trouble. And so now, but up until then, you get juvie stuff. You don't get in that much trouble. I get locked up. I'm 18. It's a Kentucky Derby weekend. I get thrown in the cell. I'm one, and there's seven Black Panthers that had gotten locked up in the west end of Louisville, Kentucky. They had brought a bunch of explosives in to blow up Churchill Downs as a statement. So my father, my mother, who have no idea where I are, and they wouldn't even want to know if they heard me say that, but who have no idea where I'm living or anything else, the next morning they found out, because on ABC News, NBC News, and CBS News, which are the only thing we had there, out come 7 Black Panthers and me and my little powder... and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. See, the other kids in school didn't get to have experiences like this. They gave senior awards in the Chit Chat, which was our newspaper. I got the Brown Foreman Award. And Brown Foreman is a distillery there in Louisville, and obviously it wasn't part of our academics at Wagner, but that's what I got. Everybody knew that I drank all the time. I was drinking 24 hours a day. I went off, and by this time I knew that I didn't stay very long at anything. I didn't stay at relationships. I had one lined up before I'd ruined this one. I went down to University of Kentucky. Here's a kid who was going to go to Brown or could have gone to West Point or the Academy and chose to not go to any of them. By the time I got out, my grades wouldn't have helped me to get into it. My uncle was a dean. He helped me get into University of Kentucky, which had to take you. It was a state school, but he still needed to help me to get in there because of my behavior. And so I'm at University of Kentucky. I'm in ROTC. And one night I'm with a group of my friends and we're sitting. And I'm in ROTC. If I just made it through, I would have gone in as an officer. But one night we were sitting and I was still reading a lot, still watching a lot of movies. That year I remember The Graduate came out, and I'd made it all the way through high school without ever smoking. I saw The Graduate 10 times. And I started smoking and had an affair with an older woman. She'd be about 89 now. But back then she looked like Ava Gardner, if you're old enough to know who that was. She was hunky. But anyway, so but one night we're sitting, we're drinking, and I was reading a lot of Hemingway. We sat, we drank, we enlisted. So I went down and sat with a drunken recruitment sergeant, and I decided I'd go in. And so I was the first enlisted guy in our family in some time. And I went to Vietnam. I had 2 tours in Vietnam. And strangely, I actually did well in combat. Now, this is the thing. If you put me in an absolute crisis, I seem to function okay. Real life, I have no clue about. But that's the way I was. And so I went over there. Now, I know that a lot of you realize I'm from Kentucky, and most people think that Kentucky is kind of the area where hip emanates. But I had actually, even though I went to college in the 60s, I had actually never seen a joint or any kind of drugs. Our drug was a bottle of Stitzel-Weller whiskey that had a little emblem on it that said Rebel Yell with a rebel flag on it. And that's what I drank. So I go off to Vietnam, and now I find a group of people that I can look down on. Because in Vietnam, some of the people were doing drugs. And I always felt like, even though I had a one holder over here for two clips for an M16, and I always usually kept some booze in there instead of the two clips. And sometimes the clips can come in handy in Vietnam. But I always had, well, I had other clips. And so, but I always carried something just in case. And so... But I felt like if you did drugs, you lacked self-discipline. And I'm not saying that I didn't smoke a few joints or accidentally do LSD on a plane ride one time. But my choice was the gentleman's choice. I was a hard drinker like John Wayne. I drank whiskey. And so I thought it was a man's drink. I just kept drinking. And I was a daily drinker who drank all the time. Who, if this makes sense, I was a drinker who drank morning, noon, and night. But I also went on binges on top of it. So anyway, I did okay my two tours in Vietnam. I managed not to get loose any stripes. I was a staff sergeant. I got out. But I knew that I wasn't going to be a career like the rest of my family because it just didn't look that promising. And I was also getting to the point where I couldn't get up and get going anyplace. And I had seen a woman and I'd fallen in love back in Louisville, Kentucky on leave one time. And I decided to move back to Louisville. I got a job that ended up being a great job. I was going to write and produce for an ad agency. I was going to do these commercials and that would teach me what I needed to go out to Hollywood. And I actually was very, very good at that. And it was a job that I could handle with my work schedule, which was usually about 2 hours a day. And so I fell in love with this woman. I came back, and she looked kind of like Olivia Newton-John. Everybody always felt I was engaged 6 times before I got to AA, and they all looked like different movie stars. And this one looked like Olivia Newton-John. And we were talking about getting married, and I was thinking things are, you know, because if you've got a drinking problem, marriage is usually a good answer. And so I'm headed for that, and we're talking about what we're going to do with our relationship. We just need to figure out what to do with her husband, and. Nixon was running for re-election, and her husband was an attorney who was an advanced man for Nixon, and so he was gone most of the time. But when he came back now and then, we had some conflicts. I was an expert marksman when I was in the service, and he was trained as an attorney, so we used different tools. I went after him a few times with a shotgun. He came after me a few times with a warrant, and so. But you know how we are. We're persistent. Alcoholics are absolutely persistent. I stuck in there until the two of them got divorced and we were ready to get married and it was 3 weeks away from the marriage. And because I had this thing where I was a daily drinker but was sometimes going binges, daily drinking was, I had some gray periods, yes, but I didn't totally black out. But on the binges, occasionally I would lose a day or two or so. And apparently I went on a binge about a week before we were supposed to get married to kind of celebrate. And I forgot to tell the girl I was marrying, and so when I got back after a couple of days, she had some reservations, and so she decided that she wanted to postpone the wedding. Now here's the way I was: whenever anything bad like that happened, I always blamed everybody else. It wasn't like I didn't want to look at my part in it; I didn't see my part in it, and so I was shocked after I had. You know, I had helped her get out of her marriage, and she was thinking twice. And so the way I did, when something like that happened and I was wounded, and I was a very sensitive person because writers are very sensitive, and because of that, what I would do is I would find some way to comfort me, to make me feel better. Now, I was already drinking as much as I could. Drugs didn't work for me. And so when I was in Vietnam, I had seen this magazine that I hadn't seen here. I'd seen Playboy here, but this is way before internet, so it's a totally different world. But there was a magazine over there called Penthouse, and they used to try like new beers in this magazine, and they let the GI see it. And in Penthouse, it had a section in there, unlike Playboy, it had a section in there of intellectual ideas called the forum or letters. And so I remember some of us guys sitting around talking about one of these intellectual ideas called a menage a trois, and. Apparently none of us in my little circle spoke French at the time. And which was interesting because we were also in French Indochina, but we didn't know that either. We didn't know a whole lot, but except this concept, it just, you know, it's one of those things, you know, something rings a bell with you, and, you know, the idea of two women and me, and just, and then later, years later, I found out it could, a menage could be two men and a woman. Not in my universe, but that was... But that didn't occur to me. But anyway, so the idea of the two... And so I think, well, I'm wounded, and this woman has cast me out, and I'm going to find... And I'm living in Louisville, Kentucky, in an apartment where there are 11 apartments. We all know each other. You have to have a reference to get in there. Most of us went to school together. We got Army, Marine Corps, all the thing, the flags up. Everybody's a veteran. Everybody's patriotic. And there was another concept in there, and I bring this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into without a sponsor. If I was going to get together with two women, I wanted the two women to like each other. So there was another concept there that I thought meant that kind of woman called lesbian. So I decide now that I need to find a lesbian bar so I can find two women that want to have a menage with me. And this is in Louisville 40 years ago. So who do you ask? See, if you don't have a sponsor, who do you ask? You know, so you know, but we are persistent. We don't give up. We just keep hanging in there. And I did. And finally, I got to, and I somehow found the place. So I go down there, and I'm sitting there, and there's not much going on. I was told this is where it's happening, but there's not much going on when I got there. And there's a woman sitting at the bar. I'm having a good time talking to her. She's another vet, but I know there's not going to be any menaging. And so, and there's a guy playing the piano. I'm at the piano bar. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, and I'm waiting for this adventure, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen. And I, you know how you have enough whiskey, and you drink enough, you know, I was smoking 4 packs a day, and I was drinking my Wild Turkey 101, and I'm drinking my whiskey, and I'm smoking, you have just enough, I smoked L&M because I like the picture on the package. And so I'm smoking these L&Ms, and I'm drinking the whiskey, and you get enough whiskey and cigarettes to get that kind of come hither voice. And it's not going to get, you're not going to get any sexier. And it's going to happen now, or it's not going to happen. And all of a sudden, just like always in the movies where the sun would shine down, and suddenly there was a door that opened at the other end of the wall, and there seemed to be some kind of activity upstairs, and there was another TV show called The Loretta Young Show. And all these references for you people, for the young people, Google them. They're on YouTube. You can find it. And so... but the Loretta Young Show had this spectacularly beautiful woman, and at the beginning of the show, she just came cascading down the stairs, just one of the most elegant things you'd ever want to see, and that was exactly what was happening, except this was in color, not Technicolor, but color, and it was a redhead, and I loved redheads from the time I was a little kid, and this beautiful redhead just comes flowing down, and all of a sudden, it's just like we're in the movies in slow motion, and suddenly we're out in the middle of the dance floor, and we're holding on to each other, and we're kissing each other, and I'm in love. And you know, when you're in love, you just can't get enough, and you're afraid it's going to go away, so you kiss a while, and then you take 3 steps this way, and then you turn and you start kissing each other again. And then I remembered my mission. I said, by the way, her name was Erica. I said, do you have a girl that we could maybe add? And she said, oh, you're into that. And I said, oh, yes. And she said, and Erica says, said, well, why don't we get to know each other tonight, and we'll add somebody tomorrow? And my thought was, thank God I did not marry that Republican woman. And so so we're kissing all the way down Forest Street downtown. We get back to my place. This is Saturday night. On Sunday morning, whoever got up first in my little complex there would go out and pop the keg and ring a bell, and everybody else would come out. We'd play volleyball in the pool. And if you had a stayover, you took her out to introduce her to all your alcoholic friends to see if she fit in. It was a great life. And so... So this is one good-looking redhead, and so we get back to my place, and drugs rears its ugly head once more. Erica pulls out a pill big enough to choke a horse. It was actually a horse tranquilizer called a Quaalude, and said, would you care for one? I said, no thanks, I don't do drugs. So I took a couple more shots of Wild Turkey, and two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after 3 or 4 days, I said, this is not right. This is the point at which my moral compass stopped working, because I had never seen Opie or Wally ever deal with this in any episode. So I did what anybody would do under those circumstances. I left town, and I was getting fired from the job I was working for, and it was a good job, but I had already gotten a job with the biggest ad agency. You know how we are. I was working for a really good regional agency, and I won a few awards, and they fired me from that job, but before they got fired, the day of, I'd already been offered a job offer with the world's largest ad agency up in New York. So now I go to New York. And here's in my mind what was taking place. I was in a town that was just too small for my talent. And so I moved to New York, and I'm up there, and I'm staying at the Plaza Hotel, and I'm staying out at the West Coast at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and eating at the Polo Lounge. Drinking at the Polo Lounge. And I had a production assistant whose primary job was to make sure that I had wild turkey, even if we were in a dry state, dry county, whatever. And I'm doing very well, and I did a number of commercials. I didn't have to work that many hours. I did a number of commercials that did one that had they tried out each year that has the football player for I was doing the advertising for Coca-Cola, and you see it each year at Super Bowl, and so I won a Clio, and then I won another Clio, and actually they knew I drank like I did, but they tolerated me because I only had to do the work a few hours a day. But as this is going on, my body was starting to break down. I had never been on a yacht before, and I'm on a yacht somewhere off of New York, and I thought if you go on a yacht, you should get a pair of white pants. This was just at the beginning of the problems with the control, but I went out and I laughed a little bit too much, and I had a little poopy, and the gang I drank with at the bar thought that was funny. But I never got invited back on the yacht. And within a short time period, I really was having some control problems. And I got up one morning and I went into a studio on the east side of New York, and we were producing music. In those days, it wasn't computers. We had a lot of live orchestra, a lot of singers, and I was doing I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, that the music for Coca-Cola. And I was the youngest creative director they'd ever had at this agency, and I'm in there, and I'm going to produce this, and I couldn't talk. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't get words to come out. And I went around the corner. I just walked out, and I went around the corner to a bar. And it was one of those small bars. It was a little hole in the wall, had a mirror that you were about 5 feet across from, not much in there, you know, the liquor and so forth, and had a couple of bottles of those jars of those things that are pickled, that are red, or I don't know what they are. I never got that bad. But but whatever they were on the bar. But I'm sitting there, and I walk in, and this guy pours me a triple of whiskey. And I hadn't said a thing to him, and my thought was, I wonder how he knows I'm a big drinker. Because I couldn't see myself. And I took it, and I spilled it all over the bar. And I had seen another film called Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where Ray Milland takes a towel and he puts it around here and he uses a lever to bring it up. And that's what I did for the next triple. And I got it down. And then I got another one down. And I got the shakes gone enough that I could walk back in there. But I'd already left, and my boss had told somebody, and they didn't fire me immediately from New York. They sent me to Atlanta. That's what they do. They send you to Atlanta. So I go down to Atlanta, and I'm working, instead of on the big main stuff, I'm working on bottler, you know, ads, buy something for 39 cents. And they were trying to help me, but I couldn't stay there. And I got fired from that job, and I was living in that apartment. And I was estranged from my family. I was estranged from everybody. I had knocked my dad down after I got back from Vietnam, the man that I wanted more than anybody to be in the world to be proud of me. I had knocked him down one night in front of the family as I was going out because he wanted to stop me from going to get more to drink, and I was already drunk. And so I was estranged from them. Even the guys that I drank with alcoholically didn't want to be around me. And I was in that, and I would come to, and I would pass out, and I would come to, and I would pass out, and I was bleeding from my stomach. I hadn't had anything. I didn't eat the last 2 years. All I did was live off of the cheapest bourbon or whatever else I could get. And when you live that way, you don't pay the rent. And when you don't pay the rent, they eventually, what's the word? They evict. Thank you. Group participation. They eventually evict you, and when they evict you, they don't give you 5 days, 6 days, or 2 weeks. They give you 6 weeks or 2 months, but that's never enough time for an alcoholic. And so they came to, I waited till the last day, and I knew that I was going to be out on the street the next day, and I went up to a liquor store to get a bottle of whiskey because it didn't matter that they were going to evict me. It didn't matter that I was going to be living on the street. It didn't matter that I didn't have any contact with anybody, as long as I had the whiskey. And I went into that liquor store, and the guy said, just a minute, he brought out the owner, and the owner said, we know that that check's no good, and we know that the last number of checks you've written are no good, and we need to ask you not to come into our liquor store anymore. And this wasn't a high-end liquor store, and as humiliating as that was, the only thought that came to my mind is, oh God, I hope he gives me that whiskey. And he did give me the bottle of whiskey, and I walked back to where I was going, and somehow, almost in slow motion, that bottle of whiskey fell out of my hands and hit the concrete and broke and spilled all over the ground. And I was more scared and more frightened and more hopeless in that moment than I ever was in any firefight in Vietnam, because I didn't know where to go. And I went inside. And I didn't have anything. When I got here, I still have it in a box. I had a pair of pants that were yellow. After the white pants I learned, I had a pair of yellow, brownish country club pants. I thought they made me look like I was country club, but they were just very practical. One blue shirt and a pair of loafers that had the bottoms out of it, but I still had a weapon. And I put a bullet in the chamber. And I started screaming at the top of my lungs at this God that had turned me away, so because I blamed God for everything that had happened in my life. And I started yelling, God blanket, God blanket, God blanket. And something happened, and something broke, and I started saying, God, help me, God, help me, God, help me. And I had a moment of peace, and that scene from another film, In Days of Wine and Roses, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. Filled that room, bigger than life, and I walked up to a phone on a street corner, and I made a phone call. I didn't even have a nickel, and I called, and this was a hot day. It was June the 8th, 1977, 32 years ago this last June. And I called, and I got the operator, and I started crying. I said, I'm an alcoholic. And because somebody had gotten the word, this is 32 years ago, not everybody knew exactly what they did, but somebody in PI had gotten the word. This woman knew what to do. And she says, hold on a minute. And she connected me to a woman who had just started working at the central office in Atlanta about a year or so before. Her name was Helen. Helen is still the general manager at the central office. And she answered the phone, and she said, honey, I know you're in trouble. And you wait right there, and I'm going to send somebody out. And she sent a guy out. His name was Ed. And Ed showed up, and Ed was normally not the kind of guy I would have associated with. Ed was a railroad man who had a bad toupee, a pipe. He was wearing plaid pants and a striped shirt. And I remember thinking, uh-uh. But I was in kind of a spot, and Ed had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and apparently that did the trick, and he started reliving the horrors of his past, and I forgot about what he looked like, I forgot about what he was wearing, I forgot about what he did, and he touched my heart, and I trusted him because I believed that he had the same disease I did. And I did the most complete third step I've ever done in my life by turning myself over to Ed that night. And Ed put me in his car. Ed was a year and a half sober. He was living in an apartment, a one-room apartment with a hot plate. And he had a brand new car. You know how we are. And so Ed, it wasn't much of a car. It was a Pinto, but it still had the sticker on the side. And Ed took me, and it was June 8th, 1977, hot day, Atlanta. He takes me, and he's going, and I was already shaking, and he's taking me to a place to dry out, and he stops at a place, and he says, "I'm going to stop here at this ATM machine and get $20, whatever." And I said, "What?" Because I had not really been involved in that much banking in the last couple of years. And ATMs had just come out, and he explained that it was, you take this card, you put it in there, and it gives you money. And my first thought was, well, if I had one of those, I wouldn't need to be calling Alcoholics Anonymous. So, but Ed said, "Are you going to be okay?" And he walked out, and I couldn't get the door handle to operate, and I threw up down the inside of his brand new, the window of his inside Pinto. And when he came back, the only thing he did was put his arm around me and say, "It's going to be okay." Because he knew that we don't have new cars, we don't have a place to live, we don't have anything if we're not willing to help the alcoholic. And I can tell you that if there hadn't been a woman who absolutely showed me love and answered the phone, I wouldn't be here. If there hadn't been a guy that was willing to come out and take a guy that threw up down the inside of his car and pick me up and take me someplace, I wouldn't be here. And from that day until now, I have never been without a group of men that would do anything 24 hours a day to make sure that I didn't have to take a drink. And if you're new, that's exactly what you walked into. But that's only the very beginning of what you walked into. Because of the way I drank, I had brain damage. So it took me about a year and a half to learn how to read. I couldn't do very much. I had no place to live there. They put me in a place to dry out, and Tony, the woman that you prayed for, was working at that place, and she helped me with all her heart. She had a year and a half, and she tried to help me, and I was having trouble. It didn't matter even when I got out of there, I was having trouble. I was in DTs for 4 or 5 days, and there was an old man named Joe H. who sat with me, and he put his arm around his hand around my arm, because when you're in the middle of a delusion, human contact can help bring you out of those. And he knew how to work with new drugs, and he helped me, and I got to the point where I wasn't shaking anymore. And so the big book says, when we take that third step, God provides whatever we need. And somebody gave me a ride to Louisville, Kentucky, and they had assigned me a sponsor before I got to Louisville. That was my hometown. I didn't have a place in Atlanta anymore, so I thought I'd go back there. And written on the back of my hand was Jack Sullivan, who was another old railroad man who'd been sober for a long time at that point. And I went back and I called him with a dime when I got to the city limits, and he said, "You're going over to meet Harry, and he's going to be at this meeting." And I stuck with those guys, and I had him and a whole group of men and a guy named Sonny that worked with me day in, day out. And I couldn't talk very well. I would get excited at the wrong place. I would laugh at the wrong place, but nobody ever called me stupid. Nobody ever told me to shut up. Now, I went to all speaker meetings, so I didn't talk that much during those speaker meetings. But our conversation took place at the Howard Johnson's afterwards, and I got to ask questions and so forth. But I was confused. I didn't know what to ask. But I got a couple of things that you need if you're going to stay sober, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you absolutely need. One, I got a sponsor, and that sponsor was there. I had a home group, and I was a member of that home group, and I got a job in that home group. And they wouldn't let me make the coffee. They wouldn't let me pour the... They wouldn't let me do anything, really, except for one job. And in that time, in Louisville, Kentucky, if you came into AA and you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learned how to smoke. And so I was the ashtray guy. And our group had 10 ashtrays, and they were round, and they were made out of Christmas tree colors. They were blue, red, green, and... red, and we had 10 of them, and they were designed by an engineer so that they would chemically fuse with the ashes every time somebody put cigarette ashes in them. And my job was to take that Brillo pad to clean them out, and I was a really good ashtray guy, and I had a lot of pride in being the ashtray guy. I really did. I had more pride in being the ashtray guy than I did in being the youngest creative director at McCann Erickson, because one was real and one wasn't. This was real life. And I was valuable, and people treated me well. And about a year or so in, I got my first raincoat. It wasn't a big deal, but I had a raincoat. And I came in, and they said, "Are there any AA announcements?" And one of the guys that was there said, "Yeah, Dick Anderson just got his first raincoat." And they all applauded. And that's the way they were. They were happy that I had my first raincoat. I didn't think it was that big a deal, but they were happy. And so I fit in. I fit in with these guys. And like the big book says, we get what we need. I was a guy, had the people that were sober, they had things like wives and jobs and houses, and I didn't have any of that. So I slept in somebody's basement where we had two beds and a bathroom because we didn't have a lot of treatment centers there, and I was the one that stayed up at night with the wet drunks. And I would stay up with them as they throwed up and during the shakes, and Joe had showed me how to work with somebody during TTs. We had a doctor who would come over and administer sedatives, just like it says in the big book. And you know what happened? At first I would get irritated at those people because I'd stay up. I'd make the sacrifice, like I had something else to do, stay up all night with them, and then they'd go off and get drunk. But they pointed out I was staying sober, and that's why we do 12-step work. And some of those guys did get sober. And after a while, all of a sudden, I suddenly did start thinking. My brain started working. And about that time, it was a year, year and a half, whatever it was into it. And I had done, they told me from the very beginning that you don't get sober by coming to meetings. You get sober by trusting God, cleaning house, and helping others. That you've got to take actions or you will not stay here. And they told me that. So I had tried, but I wasn't doing very well because I couldn't remember anything. But about a year and a half in, my brain's working. I'm starting to do things. I can start working through the steps. And I found out about something that we learn in service, the spirit of rotation. Because a couple of guys came up, and it was like I was afraid they were going to tell me somebody had died. And they said, "We have a new ashtray guy." And I said, "I don't think so." And they said, No, we have, this guy really needs the job. You're going to help him by letting him have that job, and we've got a new job for you." And two things out of that. The guy that they gave the job to, I take with great pride, was a guy named Raymond, who was down from the, he lived in the area where all the iron workers worked. His mom was a hostess of sorts at night, and didn't know who his dad was. And Raymond I don't know what the mental, it's retarded. I don't know what the politically correct word for that is now. But anyway, and he was about 5 feet tall, weighed about 300 pounds, and when they 12-stepped him, he was buck naked, swinging a dead chicken around like this. It took that kind of guy to replace me as the ashtray guy in my group. But let me tell you something about Raymond. If you've got any, if you think you can't make it, Raymond did have all those challenges. He didn't know what a family was. He wouldn't have known what functional there were, I mean, about anything. And he was retarded. But Raymond got on a bicycle and would ride 10 miles every place he went. We looked forward to him coming. And there was a big hill over to where our meeting was. And Raymond would ride his bicycle, and he weighed 300 pounds. So because he did, he would use this powder to stop the chafing. So we could see Raymond coming before he ever got over the hill. There was a big cloud of smoke, it looked like. And then Raymond comes bicycling over the hill. And he stayed sober until he died. Alcoholics Anonymous works for everybody. But they also said, "Now, we've got another job for you. We're going to make you the chairman." And I said, "I'm going to be the chairman?" No. The chairman. You're going to set up... You're going to set up the chairs. At first, I thought this was a little bit beneath me. But we had 40 chairs and only 10 ashtrays. And I'm not stupid. That's a promotion. So... So I have, except for 3 years, had a job that made me valuable to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the 32 years I've been in. When I was 12 years sober, I got burned out because I had been working a two-dimensional 12-step. I'd gotten sober, and I wanted to help everybody else get sober. But I didn't really know what the principles were and how to work them in anything. I was still fighting everybody and everything, and I was a little ungrateful. I didn't feel like that things were working out as well as they should, and my life wasn't what it should be. And so I kind of backed off from AA. I needed a little bit of a vacation for some me time. And by the time I was 15 years sober, I was in a hotel room in Los Angeles trying to figure out where to get a gun so I could put a bullet in my head. And I started over. I cried out to God, and I started over. And I got a new sponsor. John was my sponsor. The other sponsor didn't have a problem. I just wasn't talking. The other sponsor's got 52 years. John's got 50. Apparently these guys were coasting along without me, but I needed them. And John and I developed a relationship and a friendship, and I was in a spiritual wasteland. And I had to kind of start over, and I had to learn about the traditions, and I had to learn how you get along with other people. But early on in the program, now I've gone through, now I'm the chairman in my group, and I find out I start making to the real miracle part of it. When I finally, this started finally working, I realized that I did have a few resentments. I only had one resentment on my first three inventories, and finally I realized I did have a few resentments. I was angry at everybody. There was nobody I didn't have a chip on my shoulder about. And you can't live a good life if you're angry at everybody. And so I got that off, and I get through, and I'm halfway through the ninth step, and that's where the real miracle started happening. I'm apologizing to Linden Baptist Church, that church that I had yelled and screamed at and been so angry at because God turned me away there. And I go to apologize to them on a Sunday night. And I had been sober long enough that I was told that I could go out with somebody at that point. And I was looking for a significant other. And or actually just somebody who'd go out with me. And so in the audience that night, or the congregation, whatever you call it, there was a beautiful blonde girl who had never seen anybody apologize to a Baptist church before or since. And she was two things I was not looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. I was kind of looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. And but this has been my experience. If I am working a step or doing something for somebody else, God gives me what I need. And because I didn't do the picking, I'm not on my sixth marriage doing relationship workshops. Instead, I am married for 25 years next month to the girl who was the Al-Anon speaker this afternoon. And I don't do relationships very well, but God does them extremely well. And in every area where I've had a need, God has taken care of things. And I went through the rest of the amends. My final amends was to a church that I actually defaced. I was very angry at God. And I went in and I tried to find somebody to apologize to, somebody I could talk to. And there was nobody in there, and the chapel was open. And I realized what I was there for. For a couple of years, I had been asking God in the morning to keep me from that first drink and thanking God at night. And I resented and had anger and had hatred in my heart for this guy. And yet I was asking God to keep me sober. And it didn't matter. God didn't do anything. When I found out later, God had not harmed me. But I had to forgive God just like I would somebody else. And I got down on my knees and I started forgiving God. And we say it at the end of the meetings when we say, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." And one triggers the other. And when I did that, I had one of the most profound experiences I've ever had in my life. And it felt like I weighed nothing and like there was a wind blowing through my soul. And I was lifted up and I was not apart anymore. AA had brought me back to be connected with human beings by working with drunks, by letting me love people unconditionally, and you had brought me back into a relationship with people, and now you had also brought me back into a relationship with God. Not back, I'd never had one. You brought me into a relationship with God, a kind and loving God and an all-powerful God. And that's what you did for me. That's what these steps did for me. And shortly after that, I got sober with a group of men that took an annual inventory once a year. And because they believe that we have to keep growing, that we keep improving, so that I'm a better man this year, I'm a better husband this year, because there's not been a year that I've gone through that I didn't have a lot of stuff I could work on. And so I went to this retreat with them, and they say when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. And there was a priest there, and a cocky Irish priest. I don't know why I have to get all the priests from Ireland, but anyway, a cocky Irish priest. And he comes in, and he said, "You boys are always," there are about 15 of us there, and he said, "You boys are always talking about God's will." He said, "Do you know what God's will is?" And none of us ventured to guess. He said, "God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can with what you have right this moment to be useful to others. That's it. No more, no less. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If you're a husband, be a good husband. If you are a member of AA, be the best member of AA that you can be. If you have a job that you are good at and you love, do it honorably and love people through that job and serve others. If you have a job that you absolutely hate, do it honorably and serve other people through that job until God gives you something else." He says, it's not that difficult to see how God looks at us. If you men had two boys and they were both 7 years old and you gave both of them little red wagons and one took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy to all other kids and the other took the red wagon and kicked it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And I had always been the guy that took whatever you gave me and kicked it aside because I wanted something else. I made an art out of it, writing on cocktail napkins to know how to get something else. I was never happy with who I was or where I was. And a little light went on, and it changed my life. It changed my life to the extent that Barbara and I have had a wonderful life together through all kinds of challenges. Because of what you told me to do, I started communicating with my father, and I got back in touch with him. And when I got married to Barbara, because I went and made amends to a Baptist church, my dad was my best man at the wedding, thanks to you. And that woman who I got to divorce her husband so she could marry me and then she didn't, because I had made amends to her the right way, not in person, but the right way with my sponsor's help, and she knew that the change in me was real. She called me a few years later when her husband was getting ready to get fired because of his alcoholism. And I was able to get her to Al-Anon, and she was able to get her husband to AA, and they were able to get her husband to AA, and they now have three kids, and he's 22 years sober. What I didn't understand was that everything that I had been looking for in film and on TV and all over every place that I looked was to be found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just the good times. Barbara and I have had great times. We've gone to six internationals. We've gone to all kinds of conferences. We've gone all over the world. I've gone to meetings in 48 states and probably 40 countries. And we love Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to serve in all kinds of things, delegate, all the things that you do, all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things. Barbara and I sat because we spoke at an all-Scottish convention, and we went to Scotland, and we went over to Ireland, and we were sitting at the top of a hill where there was a waterfall and a path of four-leaf clovers up to the waterfall in Killarney, Ireland, and we were sitting on top of this hill looking out on one of the greenest places we've ever been with the bluest lake there and this castle in the background, and we just sat there and we were crying because God had brought us to this place, and we were crying, and people would come by and say, are you okay? And we just, well, God is so good. And you know how expressive we are. And so, we've had wonderful days together, and the day that I got married to Barbara was one of the best days of my life, and we just had a joyous occasion. But we deal with life on life's terms. And so, in 2005, Barbara had, we had put our, it started by us putting our, we had no children, weren't able to have children. We put our 18-year-old Elkhound to sleep, and we were crying and thought that was the worst thing that could happen. And within a few weeks, Barbara's mom and dad both, and we're the caretakers for them, they both died unexpectedly within a week of each other, and my mom died just a few months later, and this was the year of the International Toronto. We went to Toronto, we came back from Toronto, and I was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And if you know anything about esophageal cancer, it has over 99% fatality rate. It's the most deadly cancer of any kind. And so they told me to get my affairs in order, and I couldn't tell Barbara. And once again, I'm starting to feel alone. I couldn't tell Barbara. John knew, and my prayer partner, Keith Lewis, knew, and a guy named Ed Mutum, and some medical people and my sister, and that was it. And we were praying. I was trying to find an answer. And they said, there is a couple of places where they have a procedure where they cut out most of your stomach. They take it. They cut out all your esophagus, everything in your chest. They put this back together. You're going to have it's going to be long term. You're going to be on a feeding tube, lots of operations. And you got to be pretty strong to make it through the initial operation. But there's a place where you can go. And so we found this place out at University of Southern California. And so now I'm doing all this work, finding this stuff out without telling Barbara, because I know her just having lost her mom and dad. And because I couldn't tell Barbara, I couldn't tell you, because you don't gossip. And so so I'm not going to meetings sharing this with anybody. I'm not sharing with him. Nobody knows I have this except for a few people. And so we've worked this thing out at USC. And USC is going to, they say, yes, we can do it, etc. And I get a phone call back that they can't take my insurance. That was the day before I left to drive down to, and I was only given a couple of weeks to get this organized to have the operation. That was the day before I left to go down to Key West. I was speaking that Saturday night at the Sunset Roundup in Key West, Florida. And I had 2 days. I had found this God, this wonderful God that took care of me, that took care of Barbara, that took care of us. And I had found this, and I'm down there, and I can't even pray because I'm so angry that I'm going to die because my God can't deal with an insurance company. It took me a short time to forget how powerful God is. But here's what I was doing. My job is to ask for God's will. I was asking God to help me with my will. I had figured out the answer to this, and I'm angry at God because he's not giving it to me, and I can't pray, and I can't even talk. And a friend of mine down there said, say any prayer you can. I said, I can't even pray. He said, say whatever prayer you can remember, because that will reconnect you. God has all power, not us. He's got to solve this for you. And so I had memorized the 23rd Psalm when I was in the third grade to recite to the PTA, and I used it in Vietnam, and it's a great prayer. And I started saying it over, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and over, and I just said it, and I found a real peace. And right before I went up to speak that night, I remembered listening to my original sponsor, Jack Sullivan, after he had walked out of an office and been told he had 6 malignant brain tumors, and he knew that there was no chance for him. And when I realized what he was telling me, I said, you don't have any fear. And he said, if God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting for me on the other side. And the big book says we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And suddenly I realized it didn't make any difference. If I was going to paradise, I was going to be okay because God loved me, and everything God ever did for me was much better than anything I planned for myself. And the fear left, and I got up and spoke, and that's what I shared. And on Monday, when I got back to Atlanta, I got a phone call from Southern California, and I thought, oh, this is going to be it. And they said, we still can't take you, but our chief of surgery, who really was the guy that is taking this one step further, has gone up to Rochester, New York. Why don't you call him? And I'm thinking, I can't even get my primary care provider to call me back. I'm going to call the chief of surgery in Rochester, New York. So I called the chief of surgery at the hospital, Strong Memorial in Rochester, New York. And an hour later, he calls me back. And he says, I don't care about the insurance. You're a good candidate. I'm trying to teach the people up here how to do this operation. Come on up. So Barbara and I head up for Rochester, where we don't know anybody except we know everybody because we're in Alcoholics and Al-Anon. And we had a group of people waiting for us at the hotel they put us up. And the next day we went to that hospital and we walked in. And the very first thing we did was to walk in and report to the one who has all power. We walk into the chapel, and there on the chapel, on a wall that's 30 feet high and letters that are a foot and a half deep in gold, it says, the Lord is my shepherd. I will not want. And we walk out to see what hospital we're in, and it is Strong Memorial, endowed by Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. I'm a very good organizer, but without my help, God seemed to have put this all together pretty decently, I thought. If you're new and you've just come in here, I have good news for you. No matter how hopeless, no matter how dark, no matter how bad it's been out there, you have just walked into the land of hope, and the age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Do not leave before you find yours. Thank you.